From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Senate Judiciary Committee is considering the nomination of Jeff Sessions, the senator from Alabama, for attorney general. He's the first Donald Trump appointee to go before Congress this month, and he's been here before, testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee in 1986. He was eventually rejected then for a federal judge post after accusations that he had sympathies for the KKK and had launched a failed prosecution of black voting rights workers. He addressed all that in his opening statements today. Let's listen.
I was accused in 1986 of failing to protect the voting rights of African Americans and of condemning civil rights advocates and organizations and even harboring, amazingly, sympathies for the KKK. These are damnably false charges.
NPR congressional correspondent Elsa Chang has been listening in. Elsa, in the 80s, a judge questioned Jeff Sessions' reasoning and his attempt to prosecute those black election workers. They were cleared. And then also his critics said that Jeff Sessions made racist comments about the KKK and others. How much is all of that past history coming up today?
It's coming up a little bit, but not as much as what was expected. There was a torrent of opposition from outside groups who brought up his past. But senators today have been mainly focusing on his record for the last 20 years while he's been in the U.S. Senate.
Yeah, and he definitely has his supporters today. Here's Chuck Grassley, the senator from Iowa.
Senator Sessions' entire life of dedicated public service has prepared him for this day. If he's confirmed, and I expect that he will be, Senator Sessions will shed his role as a legislator who writes law, and he'll take on the task of enforcing the laws Congress has written.
And in general, this is going to be going on for 2 days, Elsa, but in general, you know, so far, what's your sense of, what the panel is feeling?
Well, the overall tone, I mean, on the Republican side has echoed Grassley. His Republican colleagues, Sessions' colleagues, have praised his character. They've given him multiple chances to speak directly into the microphone to anyone listening who might suspect that he's a racist, given, you know, the controversy from the 1980s. In one colloquy with Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, Graham asked him, you know, being a Southerner, how does it feel when people assume and call you racist? And Sessions says, you know, it feels bad, and that he hopes his tenure as senator has shown people that the caricature that was created of him in the 1980s is not accurate. As a Southerner who actually saw discrimination, he knows that discrimination is wrong, he says, and he knows the country needs to do better and that we as a country can never go back. Now, Democrats have been courteous. There have been no explosive back and forths, but they have been consistently hitting him on issues like immigration, LGBT rights, women's rights, and whether he can remain independent from Donald Trump, because he did campaign for Trump quite vigorously during the campaign season.
Well, talking about that independence, that came up right at the very outset because, right, as you said, he's been criticized for being a political supporter of Donald Trump, his presence on the campaign trail seeming to support Trump's calls to lock up Hillary Clinton. So here's Sessions seeming to head off that criticism in his opening statement. He's defining the role of the attorney general.
He or she must be committed to following the law. He or she must be willing to tell the president or other top officials if he or they overreach. He or she cannot be a mere rubber stamp.
And in fact, Sessions said that he would recuse himself from any questions about Hillary Clinton because of his relationship on the campaign trail with Donald Trump. But you mentioned the issues he's being asked about. Here, Sessions is asked about his views on same-sex marriage and whether the issue is settled.
Supreme Court has ruled on that. The dissents dissented vigorously, but it was 5-4, and five justices on the Supreme Court, a majority of the court, has established the definition of marriage for the entire United States of America, and I will follow that decision.
Elsa Chang, Jeff Sessions also asked whether he considered Roe v. Wade settled. How do you respond there?
Well, he said, yeah, it is the law of the land. It's been established, settled law for quite a long time, Sessions said. So he says, even though he doesn't agree with the decision, it's a decision that deserves respect. And as attorney general, he said he would follow it.
Well, let's play a little bit more. A clip from early on in the hearing when Susan Collins, the senator from Maine, was speaking and was interrupted.
And to offer my support for his nomination to be our next attorney general.
Not
If I remember, this is a woman who was yelling, his voting record is evil, do not vote for Jeff Sessions, white supremacists. Others chanted things like, no KKK. And also, this is a reference to the history that we were talking about. But there seemed to some observers that there have been far more of these interruptions than we've seen in the past. Your sense?
Well, you know, protests at congressional hearings are very, very normal. In fact, it's one reason reporters want to be inside the hearing room, not just watch the hearing on TV, so reporters can capture the color in the crowd. It is quite common to see eruptions from the crowd. However, that said, there have been many, many interruptions today during Sessions' hearing because of these protests. You know, tensions are running high. Sessions' hearing is one of the first confirmation hearings for Trump's cabinet picks. Sessions is one of the most controversial cabinet picks. So, yeah, there definitely have been interruptions in the crowd. But if you look at Sessions' demeanor throughout this morning, at least so far, he doesn't seem to be derailed at any one of those interruptions. In fact, I think he's been quite emotionally prepared that this would happen. He immediately stops talking. He waits for the interruption to stop. He waits for the protester to be led out of the room. None of the senators push for the hearing to continue as the protest is being addressed by Capitol Police officers. And then Sessions just resumes. It's been actually quite a smooth day so far.
Congressional correspondent Ailsa Chang following the Senate Judiciary hearings of Jeff Sessions, Donald Trump's nominee for attorney general. It's going to be going on for a while and we'll follow it. Ailsa, thank you.
You're welcome.
And we're also following what's going on Capitol Hill when it comes to the Affordable Care Act and the future of that very much up in the air. But open enrollment for health care continues, millions signing up for coverage. And as Michael Caputo of Here and Now contributor Georgia Public Broadcasting reports from Macon, insurance plan choices have been greatly reduced.
It's all business at this conference room in the Macon Centerplex. Here, six people from the Insure Georgia program sit behind laptop computers. They're navigators, working to sign people up for the Affordable Care Act during this one-day event. Among those who made the trip is Donna Hughes.
I'm one in that number of the many people who are lower income and can't afford regular health insurance.
Hughes works a seasonal job as an office manager for a tax preparer. The rest of the time, she cares for her aging mother. She sits with navigator Ted Hall.
All right, so I'm going to go through your application with you. Just a reminder, I am going to be looking at some of your personal
information. Hughes is renewing her insurance under Georgia's Obamacare exchange. And what becomes apparent quickly is that she'll have to change coverage plans. Her current provider has pulled out of the program, as have three other large insurers, including Aetna and United Healthcare.
So the only options you guys have in this part of the state are Blue Cross, Blue Shield. Now, they offer different types of plans, but Blue Cross, Blue Shield is the only actual provider that we would have to choose from. And I'll let you look at a few other plans.
The Atlanta area does have some additional provider choices, but Blue Cross is the only company offering health care across the state. Hughes grudgingly accepts a Blue Cross plan, but she's going to have to find a new primary doctor that's part of that network. Steve Allen is a small business owner in Macon. He's signing up on his own and will choose insurance through the ACA because it's the most affordable option. He, too, must switch insurers.
So we're having to go back to Blue Cross. It's really the only option open to us.
Fred Ammons is CEO of Community HealthWorks. His nonprofit runs Insure Georgia, which supplies navigators across much of the state. Ammons says this has been one of the biggest hurdles his navigators have had to address with consumers.
In some cities and counties where we had a little more competition, that is a barrier. Oftentimes that narrow network. So there are absolutely no easy answers when it comes to the problems caused by insurers pulling out.
The other barrier is confusion over the future of the Affordable Care Act. Donald Trump's presidential victory came with a promise. Cindy Zeldin is executive director of the Atlanta-based Georgians for a Healthy Future, a consumer advocacy group.
There's this big question mark hanging over the entire framework of health insurance for many consumers all across the country with the conversations in Washington about potentially repealing the Affordable Care Act without really communicating what a replacement would be.
But with all the change and uncertainty, Zeldin says people are still getting ACA coverage since open enrollment started on November the 1st. The latest figures from the Federal Health and Human Services Department show about 482,000 Georgians have signed up. That's slightly less than a year ago. Nationally, however, 8.8 million people have enrolled since November, roughly 200,000 more than a year earlier.
So it's clearly meeting a need, even if there may be some aspects of it that could be improved.
Open enrollment continues across the U.S. until the end of January, as the nation watches how healthcare may be reshaped. For Here and Now, I'm Michael Caputo in Macon, Georgia.
President Obama delivers his farewell address tonight in Chicago. He has given so many major speeches as president, and now there's a book of them. It's called We Are the Change We Seek, The Speeches of Barack Obama. The editors are E.J. Dionne, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a columnist for The Washington Post, and Joanne Reed, political analyst and host of AM Joy on MSNBC. They join us now. Welcome. And Joy, let's start with you. As you worked on which speeches to include in this book, what stood out to you?
Well, one of the things that was interesting is that EJ and I, you know, both compiled our own list of which speeches we thought were his best. And it was actually pretty amazing how many of the same speeches we had on our list. And one of the speeches that I think was a remarkable and really a quintessentially Obama speech was his speech in Selma, Alabama, for the anniversary of that march over the Edmund Pettus Bridge. And it's uniquely Obama for a lot of reasons. It's extremely historic in the sense that he looks at history as somebody who's not even necessarily just a president, but also an observer of American culture and American history writ large. It's got in these incredible references to James Baldwin and other poetic, allegoric references. And it really speaks to the America that he wants us to be. And what that speech has in common with actually my other favorite speech of his, the speech that he gave when he actually lost the New Hampshire primary to Hillary Clinton, and then took that speech, rewrote it really in the last minute to become this soaring treatise on hope at the moment when it seemed that the idea of a first black president was being snatched away from African Americans who were awakened to the possibility of Obama when he won in Iowa and then had those hopes dashed in New Hampshire. He turns that moment into probably the most inspirational moment in the campaign. And I think what Obama is what he says he is. He's a hope monger. He believes in the American experiment. He believes we are moving inexorably toward that more perfect union. And I think the Selma speech and that Yes, We Can speech, we call it, in New Hampshire most embody that.
Well, let's listen to a little bit from that speech in New Hampshire. This is right after he lost the primary to Hillary Clinton in 2008.
When we've been told we're not ready, or that we shouldn't try, or that we can't, generations of Americans have responded with a simple creed that sums up the spirit of a people. Yes, we can. Yes, we can.
And then there was this just a few days later after he had success in the Super Tuesday primaries, beating Clinton in many of them.
We are the ones we've been waiting for. We. We are the change that we seek. We are the hope.
So we are the change that we seek, which is now the title of your book. And yes, we can. Were these accidental or did he know that these would be phrases that would end up being repeated over and over again?
Well, you know, Yes, We Can is interesting because it has a complicated history, because it was something also that David Axelrod, his key advisor, had used as a slogan for Deval Patrick's run for governor of Massachusetts. But it became the Obama trademark, Si Se Puede, in a lot of different languages. You know, there was a party in Spain that kind of drew its name from that. So even though the roots of it were outside Obama, it became sort of the hallmark of his campaign. And the idea that we are the ones who we've been waiting for is really a community organizer's creed. And I think it's something that at his best Obama never lost, which is, you know, the job of the organizer is not to do everything himself, but to get people to do things on their own behalf.
And if I could say what's interesting about that is Barack Obama consistently references civil rights figures and uses some of their same sort of tomes, right? So King would use a lot of the same phrases that would turn up in much more famous speeches, but he'd use them in smaller speeches. Well, Barack Obama used Yes, We Can in speeches that are not nearly as famous. He used it and he directly pulled it from Si Se Puede, from Dolores Huerta, who's one of his civil rights heroes. He borrows these little phrases like fired up, ready to go, which he takes from a woman who's this 60-some-odd-year-old organizer in the South. And he hears this phrase from her and borrows it and incorporates it into his own speaking. Obama is a sponge. He picks up little phrases, little turns of phrase and ideas from community organizers and civil rights figures. And while he doesn't see himself as a civil rights leader, he sees himself as more of a convener. His idea and the big idea in his speeches is to put the ideas out there and then to challenge Americans to seize them and make the change for themselves.
I remember seeing him speak in New York. He spoke to a bunch of Wall Street executives. This is after the financial crisis, but he was talking to them about those issues. And after all of the talk of how great his speeches were, this one was not that exciting. And it's actually been written about that it wasn't that exciting. Did you notice as you were going through these speeches that at times he just turned it off? He didn't use his soaring rhetoric to make his points.
I think of the moments when Michael Brown, for instance, was killed and he came out and he comes all the way back from Martha's Vineyard to Washington, D.C. and he gets up to the podium and he talks about the death of Michael Brown as the tail end to a press conference about something else, Iraq or China. And he sort of leaves it there and leaves people wanting and leaves people really flat and a lot of African Americans really angry that he doesn't apply this great gift of his to speak to their pain, which is why when he does it, when he finally does it in Selma and in some of the other speeches that he's given, it feels like a bomb, B-A-L-M, to the people who felt that this is why we needed to have a black president.
I want to ask you about a speech that I think is often forgotten in this country, but I think it made a big difference in other parts of the world. This was a speech that Obama gave in Cairo, Egypt, in June of 2009. It's called A New Beginning. Here's a bit of it.
I've come here to Cairo to seek a new beginning between the United States and Muslims around the world, one based on mutual interest and mutual respect. And one based upon the truth that America and Islam are not exclusive and need not be in competition.
Why did you choose to include this speech? And what do you think the impact was of this speech?
I think that that speech is, in terms of policy, is going to be one of the most important. And I think it's going to be one of the most controversial of his speeches. A lot of people are still asking the question, what actually came out of that? What role did that speech play in the Arab Spring? Did Obama adequately follow through on the promises of that speech? So it was a breakthrough speech in announcing a different American approach to Islam, although in fairness to George W. Bush, he tried really hard to make clear throughout his presidency that whatever you thought of his war policies, this was not about a war with Islam, but someone named Barack Hussein Obama had a particular credibility on that. But I think we're going to be debating that speech for some years to come.
Well, and it's even more ironic that now we find ourselves with a president-elect who part of his popularity is grounded in this international movement toward a kind of clash of civilizations,
yes,
between
exactly.
Christianity and Islam. And so he's doing precisely the opposite of what Barack Obama was doing in that speech. One wonders, could Barack Obama give that speech today? Would he be able to get across those same ideas when you have people saying, no, we actually want a Russian-led war with Islam. We want a clash of civilizations.
Well, what does it tell you that Obama's rhetoric and Obama's speaking style was very effective at communicating with the American people, but now Donald Trump, who has a completely different way of communicating, is also being very effective, that these two things work with different groups, I guess?
Well, I'm not sure. You know, we've gone from a great orator to prolific tweeter. I don't know if that's progress. But It's still not clear to me that Donald Trump is the great communicator when you look at his approval rating. You know, the electorate that elected Donald Trump, according to the exit poll, 60% of them disapproved of him. So, you know, we're going to be testing Donald Trump. He is not good at the big speech to make a big argument. And his inaugural address will be the first really big test of that. Yeah. But as I say, I think we're going to miss a president who can talk like Obama could talk. And I think that may be true even for among people who did not support President Obama.
Oh, I can't tell you how many, you know, Republican friends, you know, express how much they're going to miss having the country represented by this kind of a man, this kind of a father, this kind of a person in terms of his character and integrity, but also this kind of a speaker. He certainly makes us look good. But to EJ's point, it's amazing that Barack Obama speaks when he you know, gives a great speech. He speaks to the country and to the world and is rejected by a percentage of the country. When Donald Trump communicates, he specifically only communicates to his followers. So he's not really made an attempt to do what Barack Obama does, meaning speak to the country, speak to the world. He just talks to his followers. So it is literally sort of the inverse of the Obama years.
Well, I can't say goodbye to you without saying that one of my favorite moments of this book is a speech that Obama gave in Kansas, a big economic speech. And it starts by saying, and you've got the transcript of it here, you know, it's great to be back in the state of Texas. State of Kansas. I had forgotten that he said in one of his most important speeches, he got the state wrong. But anyway,
we tried to be true to the text.
That's right. Well, E.J. Dionne and Joanne Reed, they're the editors of We Are the Change We Seek, the speeches of Barack Obama. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron, partnering with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to deliver all you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come pre-measured, so there's no food waste. Recycle the packaging or mail it back, postage free, and Blue Apron will recycle for you. Rediscover how fun cooking can be. Enjoy seasonally inspired recipes and explore new cuisines. No commitment. Get meals only when you want. Get your first three meals free plus free shipping at blueapron.com/here.
2016 proved to be a decent year for the airline industry. Total departures rose to about 35 million globally, and operating profits ticked up to around $60 billion from $58 billion the previous year. That's according to the International Civil Aviation Organization. For consumers, though, the year was mixed with additional fees and delays. So, what to expect this year? Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal has been looking into this, and he joins us now. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Jeremy.
So, what's new this year when you fly?
What's new this year? Well, you're going to be able to continue to find low fares, it appears. But what you get for those low fares, that's what appears to be changing. That a number of the major airlines now are matching what some of the really low discount fare airlines like Spirit Airlines and others of that ilk are doing, and taking away things that we, you know, that they call perks, we would sort of many people consider essentials. So, you know, it's going to be a great year in terms of getting, you know, options for low price tickets, but in terms of the comfort on board, that's where things may be continuing its downward slide.
In other words, the cheapest ticket that you find may not actually mean the most savings, because you're going to have to pay some fees for things that you might not have thought they would take away from you.
Well, exactly. For example, the overhead bin. Do you ever think about having to pay for that space up
right
there? Well, several airlines are already doing that. And in fact, United Airlines, as part of their rollout of basic economy, they're planning to charge for that space. You're going to have to, you know, check. You're gonna, just like when you pay to check a bag, if you have their credit card or if you have status, then you can be saved from that. But that's one of the things that, you know, you can't just count on having that space for free or being gate checked. You know, you get your bag, as long as you get your bag to the gate, then, you know, they'll check it and you won't have to pay anything. No, that perk is going away. At least at United, American Airlines is making changes to its policy, but we don't have the details on that yet.
And American and Delta are planning to launch new categories for travel called premium economy, which is something that exists already on United. What is there anything different about what American and Delta are doing there?
Well, indeed, it makes a bigger difference if you're flying internationally. There, it's really it's like a separate category. You've got your business class, first class. Now you'll have premium economy, where the seats will be different. You'll have the curtains that separate you from the schlubs that sit in basic economy. You'll get meals. You'll get other treats that those in the back don't enjoy, and you'll have to pay more for it.
I remember Jerry Seinfeld in an episode of Seinfeld saying to the stewardess while sitting in first class that curtain is no security. There really should be a locking door between first and coach.
And they had warm cookies up there.
That's right.
That really upset him.
Well, quickly, Jason, what about delays? Some things happening there, too.
Well, right. I mean, last week you had those major delays caused by computer malfunctions.
Right.
And there may be more of those ahead because the systems are becoming growingly complex, especially with more mergers going on. And you also, at the government level, they're still operating on really antiquated technology, and those upgrades haven't been made yet. So we may see more outages and those kinds of delays in the future.
Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal, as we hear here the theme song from Airplane. Jason, thank you.
Thanks a lot.
You've probably heard the Dropkick Murphys, the Celtic punk rock band that fills arenas across the country and has a religious following here in Boston with hit songs like Tessie. Tessie! As one reviewer says, great music, especially if you're drunk. But if you listen closely, you know the Dropkick Murphys have long had another message for addicts. Walk on, walk on, with hope in your heart, and you'll never walk alone. You'll never walk alone. That's the Dropkick Murphys' new cover of Rodgers and Hammerstein's classic You'll Never Walk Alone from Carousel. It's the centerpiece of the Dropkick Murphys' new CD, 11 short stories of pain and glory. And founding member, bassist, vocalist, songwriter, and all-around great guy Ken Casey joins us in the studio.
What an intro. Thank you.
Welcome. Look, who has not wept to this song sung in Carousel by a matriarchal woman to the young Julie Jordan after Billy Bigelow commits suicide after a failed robbery?
When you walk through a storm, hold your head up high, and don't be afraid of the dark.
I actually, I'm not so much the musical kind of guy, but the Jerry and the Pacemakers version was like the version that I always heard, and just even that version, just like there's so much sadness, there's so much hope, you know, it just kind of like brings you down, then brings you up, and you know, the song is just amazing.
At the end of a storm, there's a golden sky, and the sweet silver song of love.
The song for you had a message of what, and the album has a message of what?
Well, the band was very kind of embroiled in the opiate crisis, and that's just taking a ridiculous amount of people away. And the Jerry and the Pacemakers version of You'll Never Walk Alone came on in my car as I was leaving one of about, I don't know, 40 wakes I've been to in the last year and a half.
Some
of them,
overdoses.
Yeah, some of them family, some of them close friends, some of them, you know, fans of the band, some of them kids that we work with the Clatter Fund.
Let's stop there for a second, the Clatter Fund. After the Clatter Ring, the loyalty.
Yeah, friendship, love, and loyalty.
Yep. This is your fund in which people may not know. The band contributes to treatments, contributes to scholarships for kids who have overcome addiction. Tell us more about the Clatter Fund.
Yeah, we started in 2009. You know, we raise money for children's charities, veterans, and then substance abuse. There's, Soba High School, and we give scholarships to kids going on to college, graduating from the Soba High School, and just, you know, try to kind of mentor them and sometimes have them, you know, come to the shows and just try to show them that there's more to life than drugs, you know.
So this whole album, it's almost like a concept album about the opioid epidemic. There's songs, for instance, like Rebels with a Cause. Let's listen. This seems to be reaching out to those kids that others have written off.
I mean, yeah, in many instances, they'll say, like, the harm reduction model. Like, let's just try to make this kid not end up in jail. Let's put him on Suboxone or some other kind of thing and kind of give up on kids and just they end up being institutionalized. And, you know, I just think that we can do better than that.
But, Ken, you've long had this message. I'm thinking of Barroom Hero. This is an old Dropkick Murphys song, Face Down in the Gutter. Won't admit defeat, though his clothes are soiled in black. So you've had this message before, but you're also seen as the number one barroom drinking song band.
Yeah, I think that might be the nature of Irish music. Sometimes, no matter what the message, people sing it with that kind of, you know. Myself, I've been in long-term recovery for over 25 years. That song is written about so many people in my life that were throwing their life away to alcohol, but I don't preach it. You know what I mean? Yeah. I feel like sometimes when you kind of take things past the lyrics, kind of turns people off. This, however, with the opioid crisis, it's like when I'm at one wake after another, when I'm burying either my friend's kids or my friends, this should be front page news every day.
Pick another song. Where else might we see this? Somewhere in the lyrics, maybe not in your face.
Yeah,
but
Paying My Way would definitely be that song. And basically, paying your dues, you know, one foot in front of the other, because sometimes when you're down in the rabbit hole so far and you're saying, like, how can I ever turn my life around? I've got problems compounding upon problems, and sometimes you just got to do that next right thing and do one small thing, and you can't turn it around overnight.
Some days are hard, some days are long, some days I'm weak, some days I'm strong. I'm paying my way, I'm paying my way.
You might make fun of, you might point out flaws, but it's always in a very loving way. And there's fun on this CD, too, along with all the pain. There's a lot of fun, and I'm thinking of the First Class Loser. Let's just listen to a little of that.
Have you ever had family or a friend that drove you crazy? A foe or a neighbor who's obnoxious, rude, or lazy? The type of guy you'd cross six lanes of traffic to avoid. He's always got his hand.
A lot of my friends will be saying, when's the new album coming out? When's the new album coming out? And I'll say, well, comes out next week. Check out track 5. I wrote it about you. And they're like, really? Oh, thanks. And now people are starting to call me, you son of a.
But it's with affection. Well, as we said, the most serious message is about this damn opioid epidemic, if I may. But there's also a song that, man, I wondered how long you thought about writing this one. 4/15/13, of course. The day of the Boston Marathon bombing.
We stood in your footprints till the rain washed them away. The memories never fade. With us they'll always stay. We stand here together. We bow our heads and pray for those gone but not forgotten. We remember you each day. Ooh, we lost our innocence today.
The song, musically, like, we didn't want it to be too much of a downtrodden ballad. We didn't want it to be some raging anthem, obviously. We don't do much in the middle. We're kind of either like a ballad or raging. So I dare I say it might be slightly new ground for us, you know. And I think I'm maybe most proud of how that song came out than anything else on the record.
Well, but back to the song that is the centerpiece, You'll Never Walk Alone. You were saying you just got asked to sing it awake?
Yeah, well, no, at a funeral. You know, great friend of the band and mine, going way, way back, had just passed away way too young. And
again, opioids.
Yeah, and got to sing at his funeral.
What did you sing?
The Fields of Athenry, which was requested by Michael's mom, and it was an honor to do that in the church. But I hope I never have to sing at another funeral again.
For those who don't know it, do you mind two lines now?
A cappella? You want me to a cappella it?
Yeah.
Oh my God, I'm going to try this.
Breathe, yeah.
But low-lie the fields of Athenry, where once we watched the small free birds fly. Our love was on the wing. We had dreams and songs to sing. It's so lonely round the fields of Athenry. I've never sung a cappella, and I'll never do it again. But you know what? For Michael, I'll do anything. Rest in peace, my friend.
When you walk through a storm, hold your hand.
Ken Casey of the Dropkick Murphys will get that whole a cappella song at hereandnow.org.
There are some new guidelines from the American Academy of Pediatrics involving donor breast milk. The guidelines say premature, high-risk infants should consume donated breast milk if a mother's own milk isn't available. They also warn against buying unscreened milk on the internet. The market for donor breast milk has been growing, and the milk can be very expensive. Karen Chakraji of WXXI in Rochester, New York, reports.
She loves those elephants.
This music-making toy elephant is making 18-month-old Lucia Rojas really happy. She smiles and bobs and dances next to her mom, which is kind of a miracle considering how sick she once was.
Right, what a genius.
Lucia was born 3 months early. She weighed 1 pound, 9 ounces. Mary Sarah Rojas, her mom, says doctors told her, let's see if the baby makes it through the weekend.
I think everyone was, like, really terrified. Everyone thought she would die.
Lucia had 2 surgeries in the first 2 weeks of her life. Her digestive system was a mess. Mary Sarah pumped breast milk for months, but then her supply dwindled. So she turned to a donor milk bank in Boston.
There were no other options. I couldn't, you know, bounce from one formula to another and just try and see, oh, does she like this formula? Does she like that formula? I didn't have that as an option.
Every year in the U.S., about 55,000 babies are born prematurely and weigh under 3.5 pounds. Their digestive systems can't really process formula easily. They benefit from breast milk and its immune system-building properties. But not all moms produce milk or enough of it.
Oh, that's them. They're there.
The New York Milk Bank opened this summer in a suburb of New York City. It's small, spotless, and noisy. Several freezers throughout the main room hold breast milk in different stages of processing. Julie Boucher-Horowitz runs the nonprofit milk bank. She welcomes in one sleepy-looking customer, a new dad.
So what day of life is this? Is this the second day of life?
Michael Guinan is picking up milk for his newborn because his wife isn't producing any yet and the baby is losing weight.
Got down to about 5'11". 5 pounds, 11 ounces.
Nonprofit donor milk banks receive, screen, and pasteurize breast milk for moms who want to donate their extra milk. Those moms don't get paid. The bank then sells it to hospitals or families directly. For-profit milk banks have different protocols and price ranges.
Okay, so let's get the milk.
In 1980, there were 30 active nonprofit milk banks in the U.S. Then, between the lack of insurance coverage, formula campaigns, and concerns about HIV transmission, most of these milk banks closed. By 2000, there were only 5 left. But in the past 4 years, donor milk distribution has doubled from about 2 million to 4 million ounces. Nonprofit milk banks only charge for the processing of the milk and for administrative and overhead costs, not for the milk itself. Still, these 100 milliliter bottles are not cheap. Boucher-Horowitz loads 8 into a padded bag.
Wait a minute. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. One more.
The cost is $120. Depending on how much a family needs to purchase, this can quickly get pricey. Full-term babies consume 20 to 30 ounces a day. That can cost upwards of $80 a day.
People have always questioned the cost, but when you think about the potential benefits, the cost really isn't a major hurdle.
Dr. Jeffrey Myers runs the Neonatal Intensive Care Unit, or NICU, at Strong Hospital in Rochester, where Lucia Rojas was a patient. It's the most advanced NICU in the region, but it doesn't routinely stock breast milk. Myers says that's because it's more expensive than formula and would need special staff.
We're oftentimes stuck using formula because we don't have another alternative.
Researchers have found that premature babies who can't get enough of their own mother's milk do better with donated milk than formula. They have shorter hospital stays, lower rates of infection, fewer surgeries. It costs less for everyone. But most insurance companies and hospitals do not pay for donated milk.
We wouldn't withhold an antibiotic from a patient who has an infection and we know that's the right antibiotic.
Myers estimates 75 to 100 infants a year in his NICU alone could benefit from donor milk. Five states in Washington, D.C. currently require Medicaid to pay for it. A bill in New York State that would have required Medicaid coverage was recently vetoed.
We have 5 other freezers off-site full of milk.
Wow.
Back at the New York Milk Bank, Julie Boucher-Horowitz basks in the amount of milk they've received since opening their doors.
So do you have more milk than you know what to do with?
Well, that's a good question.
On this day, the bank has 7 freezers full of donated milk. Boucher-Horowitz is letting hospitals know the bank is up and running. For now, most hospitals and patients nationwide are figuring out how and where to get the milk on their own terms with their own dollars. For Here and Now, I'm Karen Chakurji.
And Karen's story was produced as part of the Health News Collaborative Side Effects Public Media. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.